So in Acts chapter 23, Paul has been arrested, and he is trying to defend himself before the religious authorities. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day." At this, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck." Those who were standing near Paul said, "How dare you insult God's high priest?" It's all getting a bit messy in our story now. In fact, it's been quite an interesting journey. We followed Paul on a missionary journey. So I'm going just to put a little PowerPoint on the screen. This is an underground version of the Apostle Paul's missionary journeys. And it looks quite neat and tidy according to that. But of course, in reality, it's not that neat and tidy at all. I'll just leave that on the screen while you try and puzzle it out. You can see there's the first missionary journey is there in red. That's the short one. And then there's a longer blue one. And then a very long green one. And we're about to follow him on the orange one. But that hasn't happened yet. At the moment, we're in Jerusalem, right down in the bottom corner there. Right down in Jerusalem. And it struck me that Paul has been ministering. He's ministering now as he's giving his testimony. He's been brought before the Sanhedrin. He's about to explain what he believes in. And it's a great moment, a great opportunity for testimony, but it's messy. And as a church, we try to train people, all of us, to be ministers. We are all ministers of Christ's gospel in some way, all of us. In some form or other, are ministers of Christ. But those opportunities for ministry are not neat and tidy. Ministry doesn't take place in comfy rooms all the time. Sometimes it does, but not always, not usually. It's not formal and controlled. When we minister, it's usually not structured. And it's not planned. In fact, it's usually unplanned, unpredictable, and frankly, sometimes chaotic. We often don't get the chance to follow up what we've done. It's a one-off opportunity very often. We can't control it. And it looks like random dots. I'm sure in heaven's viewpoint, and one day all those dots will be joined up. But when you and I minister, it's usually on the spur of the moment as we reach out to somebody and tell them about Jesus or just help somebody or encourage them in some way. Some of you have a powerful ministry at work and you minister through your profession and you meet people and you minister to them, but you often don't get the chance to follow up. It's messy, isn't it? When you think what we do for Jesus, it's exciting because it's new every day, but it's not always planned. In fact, it usually isn't. It happens. So that is the Apostle Paul's journey across the Roman Empire. Sometimes he's walked up to 600 miles. He's travelled by boat, and he's walked nearly all of it. And we're going to follow him on his journey, on that orange journey to Rome in later studies. But for the moment, let's go back to him in Jerusalem and let's take a look at the first four verses. I'm impressed by what we'll come to a little bit later, where the Roman centurion says to Paul, "Tell me what you know." Now, that's quite nice. Paul's been given the opportunity to say what he knows. But the response he gets is very mixed. And the first response we get is what I call the response of willful ignorance. Willful ignorance is people hear the gospel of Jesus, hear the good news about Jesus, about God coming to earth, dying on the cross and rising from the dead. As these hearers respond to Paul's ministry, we get what I call willful ignorance. They don't want to know, and so they don't know. They remain ignorant, despite the fact they've had every chance to hear. Now, one of the things that annoys me, the older I get, the grumpier I get, and one of them is people who say things like, oh, you know, the Bible is a load of fairy stories. Have you heard people say that? Nothing annoys me more than that. Bible's a load of fairy stories. In fact, the Bible is so powerfully rooted in history. And in fact, as we unpack our study this morning, we're going to see that these people, the people in the story, are very real historical figures. Today's lesson is absolutely grounded in history. And we come, first of all, to a man called Ananias. Ananias is not a pleasant character. I guess you've picked up from the story where he commands Paul to be hit across the mouth for no reason at all, against all law. The Jewish law did not allow that to happen. He tells the people standing next to Paul to hit him across the mouth. And Paul reacts very angrily. Ananias was high priest of Jerusalem from AD 46-47. He had a dozen or so years as high priest. And he was greatly hated in the nation. He was a fantastically, phenomenally wealthy man. And that kept him in power. That gave him power over people and made sure he had influence. He got called to Rome at one point, and because he wasn't doing very well, but they let him off. And he was characterized as being violent-tempered, of being very greedy. He was well reputed by the historians of the time to be had his hand in the till. He was using his position to steal from money that was specifically for the temple and for the worship. He sheltered some very violent people. He had hitmen, kind of, as it were. Extremely unpleasant man. Was responsible for ordering the death of James, the apostle James. He came to an unpleasant end in AD 66. There was a bit of an uprising, and the local people lynched him. He was lynched by the Jews of Jerusalem. So Ananias did not have a long life ahead of him at this point. And he was going to meet a very unpleasant end, not that he knows it. At this point, he was still in power and still felt that he had all the cards in his hand. He was a member of the Sadducee party, which meant he did not believe in the resurrection of the dead, which is a bit awkward when you've got somebody before you saying that Jesus had been crucified on order of the Sanhedrin, and had risen from the dead in Jerusalem. So you're going to have a clash. And the Sanhedrin was split between those who believed in the resurrection and those who didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. So they were theologically divided anyway. Paul is replying to him and trying to explain what's happening. And in verse 5 says, Paul, they say, how dare you insult God's high priest? Paul replies, I think, sarcastically, saying, I did not realize that he was the high priest. In other words, this is your high priest? Come on, you know, he's not behaving like a high priest. Why should I respect him? He needs to behave like a high priest. So we meet our first character this morning, willful ignorance. He's hearing about Jesus. He's got every opportunity to hear about Jesus. But because of his position, he would lose out if he became a Christian, if he became a follower of Jesus. He is going to resist the gospel. He's going to remain in willful ignorance. He is not going to accept the message, no matter what's said. And so Paul starts an argument by talking about resurrection, and there's a theological argument in the Sanhedrin. They can't make up their mind about Paul. They can't make up their mind about anything at this point. So Paul gets taken back to prison. And then you have a little bridge in the chapter, which I love. It's in verse 11. And it says this: "The following night, the Lord stood near to Paul and said, 'Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome.'" Now, that is a great encouragement to Paul. At the moment, his life is messy. His life is really not going well. He's in prison. He can't get out of prison. He can't get a fair hearing. He's actually wanting to go to Spain. Well, so do you. But you want to go on holiday. He wants to go there to preach. And but he's stuck in prison. So God appears to Paul and says, "You must go from Jerusalem and you must also testify in Rome," which was good because he wanted to preach in Rome, and go to Rome and then go on to Spain. That was his idea. So he's going to get there, but God doesn't tell him how long it's going to take or how difficult it's going to be to get there. God tactfully omits that point at this stage. And then we move on to another character. At this point, Paul has relatives in Jerusalem. And as you read on in the story, you'll find that one of the relatives discovers that there's a plot to attack Paul. The idea is to get Paul out of prison on his way to court. And on the way to court, a group of men are going to, 40 men have vowed to ambush the party taking Paul to court and kill Paul there in the street. So Paul's nephew hears about it and tells Paul, and Paul sends him to the centurion. And in verse 19, we get this lovely phrase: "What is it you want to tell me?" the commander says. The Roman centurion says, "What is it you want to tell me?" Which is a kind of phrase I loved. Kind of phrase I'm hoping to hear in people. The kind of phrase we're hoping to hear from people in the Alpha Course. What is it you want to tell me? A lot of Bible commentators point out that that Luke, in his story, is very, very positive about centurions. Whenever centurions appear in the book of Acts, they're always nice guys. I'm sure they weren't all nice guys because they were tough soldiers, highly trained soldiers across the Roman Empire. But whenever one appears in the book of Acts, he's always a nice guy. Some theologians have suggested that perhaps this book was written as a defense for the Apostle Paul in Rome. I don't think it was. But if that were the case, then that would explain why he always portrays centurions in positive light. We're going to meet another nice centurion later on in our story in a few weeks' time. But I like this guy. He's been through a difficult time. First of all, he gets called to a riot and finds the Apostle Paul in the middle of it. So his nerves are on edge. Then he thinks he's arrested a well-known terrorist, an Egyptian, who's also mentioned in other histories of the time. But turns out it isn't. Paul isn't a terrorist at all. He's just a preacher. He's just a theologian. He's let him defend himself, and that hasn't gone well. He tries to get the Jewish authorities to give him a fair hearing. They won't give him a fair hearing. And he can't get rid of him because Paul turns out to be a Roman citizen, so he's stuck with him. So the guy really has got, you know, what does he do? But he's an open-minded man. That's what I love about him. So he doesn't send Paul's nephew away. He says, what is it you want to tell me? And when that happens, he finds out what they're planning to do. He gets his soldiers together and sends a detachment of a couple of hundred soldiers and horsemen down to Caesarea with Paul in the middle of them. And Paul is probably his best defended that he's ever going to be in his life. And he goes down to Caesarea, still a prisoner, and he's put under guard there. But I do like that word. What is it you want to tell me? The centurion doesn't understand at this point. We don't know if he went on to become a Christian. We don't know that. But there's an open-mindedness about the man. What is it you want to tell me? Compared to the willful ignorance of the religious man, this secular man, this soldier, is open-minded. Tell me about your Jesus. Tell me about him. It's a kind of attitude that produces wonderful results in the Bible story. So we move on then to chapter 24. And I hope you are following this in your Bibles, or at least in your mind. And we find Paul goes down to Caesarea, where the Jews come down. And this time, they decide to hire a lawyer called Tertullus to present their case against the governor, a man called Felix. Tertullus is a professional lawyer who... They see they're not getting very far, so they bring in the professional to try and argue their case. And that down in Caesarea, he's been passed on by the centurion to a man called Felix. Felix means for happy in Latin, of course. But I'm not sure he's a particularly happy man. Again, those people who tell me, oh, the Bible, you know, it's a load of fairy stories. Felix is a very historical character. We know a lot about him. He was born a slave, as was his brother, a man called Pallas. But they were both freed. It wasn't uncommon for slaves to be freed. But Pallas went on to become the servant of the emperor's mother. And he then went on to become a head of the civil service for a time in Rome. Pallas became an extraordinarily wealthy man, very highly placed, and he ensured that his brother Felix rose up through the ranks as well, which is how Felix has ended up in Palestine as the governor of Palestine. Felix married three times in life. Three times he married for position and for wealth. First time he married the granddaughter of Antony and Cleopatra. And his third wife was Drusilla. We'll come across Drusilla in a moment, who's the daughter of Herod Agrippa, the king. Felix, however, didn't do very well in life. And he mishandled very much the situation in Palestine. And at one point, he allowed a revolt to get very much out of control. And there was massive bloodshed. He got called back to Rome, and he got removed from high office. He's mentioned by Tacitus, who was one of the great Roman historians. And this is what Tacitus describes of him. He says of Felix, with all cruelty and lust, he exercised the power of king with the spirit of a slave. That was the Roman historian's view of Felix, and that's the man Paul is trying to defend himself before. Okay, you've got the idea of a man who is a very bad guy, and even Roman historians reckon that Felix is a bad man. And here is Paul, desperately trying to explain himself. Of course, Tertullus gets to speak first, and if you read through the account, he panders to Felix, says, "We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you," which wasn't true. Felix was a disaster. There's always problems when Felix was around. And we're grateful to you, Felix. Actually, they hated Felix. But he's a lawyer and he's trying to win the case. He accuses Paul of being a troublemaker, and you will discover as you read through it that his description of what happened in Jerusalem matches no one else's description. It's a pack of lies. But Felix motions to Paul and says, Paul, tell me about it. And then in chapter 24, once again, you will find Paul giving his story of how he became a Christian and how he was on his way to arrest Christians when he met Jesus and became a Christian on the road to Damascus. And he's back in Jerusalem bringing gifts for the poor. And he's been arrested for no reason. And he's got nothing, no case to answer. Felix, however, if you go into verses 22 to 26, Felix, it says, was well acquainted with the way. So here you have a man who's listened, he's heard, he's not willfully ignorant, he's found out about Jesus, but he has decided to reject Jesus because he would lose position and power, and so he has turned his back on Jesus. He's listened, tell me what you know. He's listened to Jesus, but in fact, he's rejected it. And his wife is there, Drusilla, who's Jewish. Let me tell you about Drusilla. We know quite a lot about Drusilla. She was the youngest daughter of Herod Agrippa, but she was a female pawn in the power games of the time. As a child, she was betrothed in marriage to a crown prince. But that didn't work out because he refused to convert to Judaism. So instead, she was given by her brother in marriage to the king of Emesa. That's where Homs is in Syria today. That's been in the news. So she was given in marriage when she was still a teenager to him. But then Felix took a fancy to her and persuaded her to leave her husband for himself. And she did. She was only 16 at the time. So Felix enticed her away from her husband, and he married her instead. If I tell you that Drusilla's father, Herod Agrippa, killed the Apostle James, her great uncle, Herod Antipas, killed John the Baptist, and her great-grandfather, Herod the Great, killed the babies in Jerusalem and tried to kill Jesus, you kind of get a picture of her family tree. You know, this would be just such a great program for Who Do You Think You Are, wouldn't it, eh? Oh, my word. Can you imagine her in tears as she finds that all the male relatives have been slaughtering men of God for the last couple of generations? That would be a good program. But it all turns out badly for her and for Felix. Felix gets called back to Rome, and in fact, it all turns out very badly for him. Even his brother really couldn't keep his job. So Felix rejects Jesus, but loses his position anyway. And a man called Festus takes over. He's new, he's got no background, and decides that he's not going to get involved in this. He'll send Paul back to Jerusalem for a trial. Paul knows that if that happens, he'll die. So Paul then asks to be sent to Rome to be tried in Rome, which is his right as a Roman citizen. And Festus agrees to that. And we'll just pick up on that story next time. But in all this, you know, all this time, in 2 years passes. 2 years in prison. And Paul's got a stretch to go yet. Ministry is messy. And Paul is ministering to people who respond differently. Some remain willfully ignorant. They don't want to hear. They don't want to hear about Jesus, so they don't examine it. Some, like Festus, examine Jesus, find out about Jesus, and then decide they're going to lose too much if they accept Jesus and they walk away. And others are open-minded and ready to hear and ready to act on what they hear. In the meantime, Paul is waiting. And waiting is never easy. Watch and pray, said Jesus. Paul has to watch and pray, wait in prison, wait for opportunity to go and preach in Rome. That will come, but he's got to wait. So as much as ministry is messy, also, you know, the Christian life involves sometimes periods of waiting, down times when not much is happening, when we're frustrated. So let me encourage you. Paul will get to Rome, but it's going to take a while.